MacCast, Sunday, August 23rd, 2020. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast on a very hot summer day. I can tell you, the studio here, I don't have air conditioning, so it gets pretty warm in here as I'm recording these shows. The temperature goes up. I try to cool it down before I get in here, but man, it is going to be a hot one. But that's okay, because we have a bunch of really great Apple and Mac news to get into, some really fun stories to get into. One maybe not so fun, at least not one of my favorite things, but a little controversy going on, so at least we have some excitement happening in the Apple and Mac community. Well, I guess we got lots of excitement because we're going to talk about iPhone 12s. Those are right around the corner. A lot of people probably thinking about their next upgrade and want to know the details. When are we going to see them? Apple has already sort of told us that they're going to be a little bit delayed, but we have some details and some additional information about what we can expect coming up in the fall here with the iPhone. We're also going to get into a bunch of Apple TV Plus news, a bunch of entertainment stuff. That's, I guess, a new part of our Mac community now that Apple is making TV shows. But there's a bunch of news to talk to you about in that regard, and also some information on the services front. We're going to get into that controversy that I alluded to, and you might already know what I'm talking about. And Apple is looking at expanding some of their repair programs, which is good for those of us who have older Macs. I think it's good, but we'll talk about that a little bit too. And that'll kind of round out the news. And then we've got a bunch of mysteries to help folks solve in the back half of the show. Received a lot of emails from folks having various little problems and issues and questions. We have a case of a missing icon. We're going to talk about memory usage and websites and some issues there. And a little bit of a mystery with reminders and repeating reminders. We'll get into that. And then a question really about archiving. And that'll round out this week's show. So like I said, should be a good one. But before we dive into everything, I do want to take a quick moment and thank a show sponsor, and that is Smile. Absolutely love Smile and all of their applications here on the MacCast. I couldn't get through my workflows and my workday without them. I want to talk to you this week, though, about Text Expander. It is a great application. It can remove a lot of repetition out of your work. It can save you a lot of time by saving you typing. Basically, anything that you have that is repetitive. So in my case, a classic example is I answer a lot of emails, a lot of email questions. As you might imagine, I get a lot of the same questions over and over again. And so what I can do is I can put a lot of my responses and answers into little snippets. And I even have the ability to add in optional text. I can put in fill-in fields. So a lot of the responses I want to personalize, or it might need to be slightly adjusted for maybe different operating systems or iOS versus macOS. And I can do all of that with Text Expander. It really is a great tool that helps save you a lot of time. It can also save you from errors. If you're like me and you do spelling errors or mistypings, you don't have to worry about that because you type it in once, you make sure it's perfect, and then you just have a little Text Expander snippet to expand that automatically. And it works everywhere across all of your apps, across all of your applications, even in your web browsers and web forms. And that makes it super handy. It also works across all of your platforms. So any platform, anywhere where you type, you can get back time and increase your productivity. It really does help you a lot. And especially for teams and corporations, if you want to unify your messaging, you can share all of your snippets and you can make sure that everybody's on the same page and you're keeping your communication accurate and consistent and having the same voice. It is an amazing tool. And best of all, show listeners can get 20% off their first year. Just visit textexpander.com/podcast to learn more about Text Expander. And a big thank you to Smile for their support of the show. That's textexpander.com/podcast. So let the iPhone 12 release date, special event date speculation begin. We are in that heavy season. We already know that Apple said that they were going to miss their regular September launch for iPhone, but we don't know exactly when they're going to be making their announcements or when the new device will be available. All we have is leakers and speculation, and this week we did have Apple leaker John Prosser say that he thinks the event will happen the week of October 12th, and he also believes that there's going to be a staggered release for the devices. And we've heard this before, meaning that the iPhone 12 models could come first, followed by the Pro versions later. And if accurate, that could mean that we could see pre-orders of the devices happening as early as Friday, October 16th for the iPhone 12s, with shipments possibly following along the next week. And then the iPhone 12 Pro models might ship sometime later, maybe even as late as November. We don't really know how far into November it could be. They could still come all at once, right? This is all just speculation, but we have been hearing this rumor of a staggered release for a while now. At one point, it was kind of sounding like it was going to be the iPhone 12 and then the base iPhone 12 Pro model, and then we would have the higher end iPhone 12 and the iPhone 12 Pro Max model later. But that rumor kind of never made sense to me. I always felt they would do the iPhone 12s first and then the Pros later, which is something they have done in the past and makes a little bit more sense. Prosser also said that he believes that Apple will roll out an Apple Watch Series 6 and an updated iPad model the week of September 7th. So he's expecting Apple to roll out some new updates before the event in October. It does seem a little bit odd, though, for the Apple Watch, especially since typically that is announced by Apple alongside the iPhones at their iPhone event. But it is a little bit different year, so we could see them doing that. We did see Apple post a test stream on their YouTube account this week that was quickly pulled, that hinted at a September 10th date for an event, which would be a little bit weird because that's a Thursday and Apple typically does their stuff earlier in the week, and it will also be a little bit early for an announcement of iPhones, but it could be for an Apple Watch announcement. But it would feel a little bit odd that they would just announce an Apple Watch, maybe an iPad, but really that feels like something that they could just put out a press release for and just release at that time. So I don't put a lot of stock in the whole YouTube thing. You know, I think Apple was probably just testing some stuff and somebody forgot to flip a switch, and maybe that was the original planned date for the iPhone 12 announcement. Who really knows? But I do feel like that week of October 12th date does seem about like the right time frame, and Prosser has been accurate with some Apple rumors in the past. So if you're kind of setting your date or wondering what that date might be, I think that's a pretty good guess. Another thing that is expected for the iPhone 12 this year is that we will be getting all 5G models, and Ming-Chi Kuo thinks that adding 5G to this year's iPhone will significantly increase the build cost for Apple, but he doesn't think that Apple will be passing all of that cost on to the consumer. He thinks support for sub 6 gigahertz is going to run Apple about $75 per unit, and the millimeter wave technology could end up costing about $125 per unit. So quite a significant increase to the build cost for Apple. Now, to help offset the 5G cost, Apple is reportedly looking to save on some of their other components by putting pressure on their dealers and suppliers for a better deal. And one component that Kuo thinks Apple is trying to get the cost down on is their battery printed circuit boards. So they could be using some of those deals and that pressure to help offset those costs so that they don't have to pass it all along to consumers. Another thing that we've seen and heard about that could help explain why Apple is doing this is that there have been the rumors that Apple and this year's iPhone won't have the typical accessories that we see, things like the EarPods or even a charging brick. And now that's upsetting for some folks, but that could be another cost-cutting measure by Apple to help bring the overall cost down so that they don't have to charge, you know, a lot more for this year's iPhones, which consumers might not respond very well to. Apple typically tries to keep the price point the same. We have seen them do increases in the past. Obviously, they've moved up in the past few years with the iPhone Pros, but I don't know. I think they've kind of hit the ceiling on that. I don't know that they can go much higher than where they're at with the iPhone Pro cost and really get away with it. So it'll be interesting to see if Apple does pass any of that savings or the savings, if Apple does pass any of that cost, onto us as consumers. But I hope they don't. And it's looking like they're trying at least not to. There are also some rumors out of the supply chain hinting at some iPad updates, an iPad Air 4 update to be specific, happening sometime in 2021. The design is expected to adopt a lot of the features of the current iPad Pro, things like the smart connector on the back for connecting to Apple's smart keyboard, and they are also expected to transition away from the Lightning connector to USB-C. The new model will reportedly have an 11-inch liquid retina display with reduced bezels, and storage will be between 128 gigabytes to 512 gigabytes. And you may remember, we've had rumors for a while that Apple had been working on a 10.8-inch iPad update, so it's very likely this 11-inch iPad Air 4 could be the update that we had been hearing about. Now, oddly, this report claims that the updated device will also have a significantly higher price point, about $150 US higher than the current iPad Air model. So that puts a little bit of suspicion on it. Again, I don't think Apple's going to be wanting to drive prices up of their devices next year. But I guess if it has significantly improved technology, they could move the price point in that direction a little bit. But that does kind of muddy up, I think, the iPad lineup and the pricing, the price points a little bit. So I don't really see them doing that. The other thing that was mentioned in the supply chain rumors was that there could be an iPad Pro update that could arrive next month. If you were paying attention earlier, that sort of backs up and supports John Prosser's rumor of a possible September 7th event coming with an iPad update. So if you've been waiting for an update to the iPad Pro, that might be just around the corner. Turning to Apple Entertainment news now, a new kind of segment here on the show. Yep, we've got a lot of Apple TV Plus news happening this week. Apple signed a new first look deal with Martin Scorsese's Scalia Productions. That means that Apple will get the first shot to develop both film and TV content from Scalia Productions for their streaming service. Apple is already working to bring Scorsese's next film, Killers of the Flower Moon, starring Leonardo DiCaprio and Robert De Niro, onto their service. Now they will have a chance to do a lot more work with Scorsese's production company. Apple signed a series order for a new animated version of Harriet the Spy based on the book series from the 1960s. The series will be animated by Titmouse Animation Studios and executive produced by the Jim Henson Company, Rehab Entertainment, and Two Friends Entertainment. Voices will include Beanie Feldstein, Jane Lynch, and Lacey Chabert. A few weeks back, I think we had the news about Apple getting a first look deal with Idris Elba's production company. Well, it looks like that relationship has now bore some fruit. They are set to produce an untitled spy romance for Apple TV+. Apple also announced a new music talent search reality show coming to their Apple TV Plus service called My Country. The show is going to be produced by Reese Witherspoon's Hello Sunshine production company. Apple's PR says it's going to revolutionize the music competition genre with a fresh new documentary sensibility. Also, filming has resumed on Apple's second season of For All Mankind. That's their series that takes an alternate look at the space race during the 1960s. When the COVID shutdown happened, they were actually just two episodes away from finishing season two. We've already seen the season two trailer, and I have to say, it looks amazing. I actually really enjoyed For All Mankind, so I'm looking forward to the second season. So the news that they are wrapping it up is something that I am personally pretty excited about. And then lastly, in entertainment news, Apple also ordered a second season of the new TV series Ted Lasso. The first season just premiered on Apple TV Plus about a week ago and features Jason Sudeikis from SNL as a U.S. college football coach who gets hired to coach a premier soccer team in England. And I have to tell you, I was recently on Ken Ray's new show In a Few Minutes, and we did talk a little bit about Apple TV Plus and some of our favorite shows, and he mentioned Ted Lasso was really good, and I had an opportunity to watch it, and I am really enjoying it. It's another great TV series, and I think, as Ken put it, and he said it in a really nice way, it's actually a comedy show, but it has a really nice heart to it. So it is, it's fun and just entertaining and heartwarming, and I've really enjoyed it so far. So if you haven't had a chance to check that one out, check it out, and it's not surprising that Apple has ordered up a second season. We know that Apple has been working heavily at expanding their services business. We have all kinds of services with Apple now, far beyond iCloud and Apple Music. We now also, of course, have what we just talked about, Apple TV Plus, Apple Arcade, and Apple News Plus. And something ever since Apple started rolling out the services that many of us have wanted, or at least wished Apple would put together, would be some sort of bundle package to lump all those services together at a discounted price. Well, it looks like that might be coming. We've talked about it, we've heard rumors about it, but this week Bloomberg says that Apple is working on a bundled service plan to launch alongside their new iPhones in October. Internally, the bundles are being referred to as Apple One, but they're actually a number of different bundles, so that part is a little bit confusing. They say that there is going to be several tiers of Apple One: a basic package with Apple Music and Apple TV Plus, a version that includes Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, and Apple Arcade, a higher version that includes Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, Apple Arcade, and Apple News Plus, and then finally their top tier, which would have all of those services plus bundle in iCloud storage and other services. The idea is to offer packages that would give customers a better deal than subscribing to the services individually, and they're saying that the bundles would support family sharing for up to 6 members, and that they're looking to offer savings between $2 to $5 a month. Now, that doesn't sound like a whole lot to me, but, you know, $60 a year, I guess, if you're on one of the higher level packages is okay. That's what bugs me a little bit about this rumor. The thing that, you know, they're saying they're going to call it Apple One, but then they're going to have all of these tiers, which I think is very non-Apple-like. It sort of makes it more confusing. I think I really envisioned them doing something more like Amazon Prime, where it's a single service at a single discounted price, and then you sort of just get everything included with it. And I would be okay if it was just Apple's new services, Apple Music, Apple TV Plus, Apple Arcade, and Apple News, without iCloud bundled in. But if they could do something where it sort of encompasses everything, including iCloud and iCloud storage, I think they could have a very compelling service there. Now, the piece also mentions that Apple is working on a new fitness service that would include virtual classes. Mark Gurman over at Bloomberg says that the service is codenamed Seymour, and that is actually something that MacRumors reported on back in March. Although back in March, MacRumors said it was going going to be a new free app with guided fitness lessons. This new rumor is sort of pointing to something more like a Peloton-like service, or a service that you would subscribe to rather than a single app. They also say that Apple is looking to bundle some of their new services with their along with hardware purchases, for example, offering a free year of Apple Arcade with the purchase of a new Apple TV, similar to the way that they offered a free year of Apple TV Plus. So Apple looking to really promote and roll out their services more as they go forward. Again, initiatives that we knew they were already pushing toward, but the idea of having a full bundle and some of these other features and services is pretty exciting. Another thing that happened on the Apple services front this past week was Apple rebranded Beats One to Apple Music One, and they added a couple of new stations, two to be exact, Apple Music Hits and Apple Music Country. I haven't had a chance to check them out too much yet, but I did notice that Apple Music Hits is playing hit music from the 90s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. So that is a station for me. I'm not a huge country fan, but I know a lot of people out there are, so it's nice to see Apple diversifying, because Beats One, to me, did seem very heavily R&B, hip-hop and electronica influenced, so the fact that we have some additional options means that I think it opens it up to a broader audience. I didn't do a lot of listening to Beats One, although I think I might be listening to Apple Music Hits a little bit more. And then the sort of elephant in the room story for this week, I guess I kind of buried the lead a little bit. Epic and Apple going at it battle royale style over the Apple Store. If you've been following any Apple news at all in the past week or so, there's no way you could have missed this story. Unfortunately, I don't like covering this sort of thing because it deals with lawsuits, but it's now too big to ignore, so we kind of have to talk about it. For those of you who maybe don't know what's going on, Epic, the game company behind Fortnite and Infinity Blade, they don't like paying Apple, or Google for that matter, the 30% cut that they take for in-app purchases in their game. Now, Fortnite is actually a free game, but they have in-app currency called V-Bucks that they sell, and that allows players to buy skins and other in-game items. And so when they do that on iOS, they have to do it through in-app purchase, and they have to give Apple 30%. Well, they've never been very happy about that, and they've decided to draw a line in the sand and sort of start a fight with Apple. Another thing that's happening is they also have their own game store for their own streaming gaming service, and that is another thing that would not be allowed on iOS, because you're not allowed to have an app store, basically, on the App Store, which kind of makes sense, or an app that it operates like an app store on iOS. It's against Apple's terms of service. Now, when Epic signed up to be with Apple, of course, they signed these terms of service, and now they really don't like them. So what they did this past week was, first, they asked Apple for an exemption, a side letter, basically, to allow them to use their own in-app purchase system. And when Apple said no, they promptly added it to their app anyway, and they did this through an update on the service on the server side. So after the app update got approved and pushed out to the App Store through Apple's normal process, they activated this, and of course Apple didn't like that. They promptly pulled the app from the App Store, and then following that move, Epic immediately filed a lawsuit and launched an online campaign that included a parody of Apple's iconic 1984 ad, sort of mocking Apple and saying that we need to hashtag free Fortnite. And for Apple's part, when they pulled the game from the App Store, they did only pull it for new installations and updates. So if you already do have Fortnite installed on your iOS device, it is still there. And as a matter of fact, it still has the alternate payment system in it, which is a clear violation of Apple's terms of service. But Apple hasn't gone so far as doing what they could do, which is activating their kill switch to completely kill the game on all devices, no matter where they are. Now, Apple is also now threatening to revoke Epic's developer license if they don't remove the in-app purchase system from their app. If they do that, they would be allowed back on the App Store, and Apple has said that they are happy to work with Epic to make that happen. Of course, that's not exactly what Epic wants here, right? They are going for a lawsuit to basically force Apple to allow them to have their App Store and also to have an alternate payment system. So essentially, it really looks like they were trying to get their app pulled from the App Store so that they could trigger this whole lawsuit and this media blitz and campaign about how unfair Apple's system is and how Apple is using their App Store as a monopoly to take advantage and force developers to pay the 30% cut. Now, the thing that may have backfired on them a little bit is Apple's threat to actually revoke their developer license, which impacts another core part of Epic's business, which is their Unreal game engine, which is used by a lot of other developers in their iOS games. So that could bring about some possible collateral damage, meaning that, you know, Epic wouldn't be able to develop new versions of that Unreal engine on the iOS platform and make them available to other developers. So this whole thing has gotten really messy and really complicated really fast. And as I said, I don't like talking about lawsuits too much. I tend to try to ignore them for a lot of these reasons. They're frustrating. Everybody starts to kind of pick sides and get upset. I'm trying to remain neutral in this thing and just figure out where all the facts are. The one thing it feels to me is that Epic for sure orchestrated and calculated this knowingly, both against Apple and Google, knowing how they would respond and that they would kick them off the App Store and that they would get a lot of press coverage for this. They are getting a lot of coverage, obviously, on this show and on the internet and many other places. It was also timed very well with Apple, Google, and others being called in by Congress to testify on anti-competitive behavior, so they definitely knew what they were doing. I kind of have mixed feelings about it because I do feel like Apple has had a struggle with developers, and a lot of times some of their decisions and policies seem a little bit odd. I also take a little bit of issue with Apple saying that they treat all developers equally within the App Store, because we already know that they've done some special deals in a few different cases, and I think that was one of the things that maybe Epic was hoping for, that they would offer them up a special deal, but when they didn't, I think they kind of said, hey, we're going to take our ball and go home and we're going to fight you. And so they've kind of done this thing to try and make Apple look bad and look like a bully. But these are both large companies. These are not the people that I feel for with Apple's sort of developer App Store policies and the fees that they charge. I think it's much harder for smaller developers. Epic can definitely afford to pay the cut, and it's pretty much industry standard, although Epic has their own reasons for saying why they shouldn't have to pay 30% to Apple, even though they pay 30% to folks like Microsoft and Sony and some of the other platforms for being on gaming consoles. So they basically say they get more promotion, more marketing value over there, and that's something that Apple is not delivering. And they basically see Apple as just a platform to distribute their software on and not necessarily a platform partner like they do those other services. So there's back and forth going on here. You know, I definitely think that Epic could resolve this pretty quickly for themselves in terms of getting back on the App Store. They basically want an injunction, a legal requirement forced against Apple to allow them back onto the App Store with their offending payment platform in place. That's not really going to happen, I don't think, because basically they forced themselves to be in that position, right? They made it so that Apple would kick them off of the App Store so they could file the lawsuit. So I think it's very obvious what's going on here from their end. But this is definitely something that has hit other developers, right? We heard about this recently with Basecamp and their Hey app, and they had to go through hoops and kind of work with Apple to figure out a way to get their app, their new app on Apple's iOS ecosystem without sort of violating the terms of service. And it came up again this week with another app, this time WordPress. They released an update and they got removed from the App Store. What was going on here was that they had a page basically within their app. The app is free. It's for people who run WordPress, which is an open source software. But within that app, they also had a help section with some links that went to the WordPress website for WordPress.com, which is their paid hosted service, and was promoting that service. And Apple's terms of service definitely says that you can't have links to an external site promoting paid services outside the App Store without also offering an in-app purchase option through their in-app purchase system. That's a violation of Apple's terms of service. They were able to work that out with WordPress. WordPress agreed to remove the links, and the app was allowed to stay in the App Store. So, you know, they went the higher ground route, the route that Epic could have gone to get their app back in the App Store. But Epic is choosing to fight a very public battle against Apple. And we're just going to have to sit back, wait, and see how it all pans out. Sides are being made, lines are being drawn. Of course, Microsoft came out in support of Epic, but that's also because Microsoft has an interest in getting their own streaming app service that they've been working on onto iOS devices possibly at some point. And so, of course, they'd like to see Apple sort of open up and allow that sort of app in their ecosystem. So it's interesting. We are going to see more lines being drawn and more sides being taken, and we're just going to have to wait and see how all of this pans out. Like I said, I know this this kind of story kicks up a lot of thoughts, a lot of opinions. And so if you have a strong opinion one way or the other, or just feelings about this in general, I'd love to hear what you have to say. Shoot me an email or an audio comment to maccast@gmail.com. And then finally, in the news for this week, looks like Apple has expanded their Indie Repair Program. The Independent Repair Provider Program has been expanded to include Macs. This was something that Apple opened up for iPhones a while back, but specifically iPhones that were out of warranty. This new version for Macs is a similar style program. Mac Rumors was able to get some of the details, which include that the program is extended to repair shops that can qualify to gain access to Apple Genuine Parts tools and training starting on August 17th. The program covers all Mac models and is limited to out-of-warranty Mac repairs. Components that are eligible for repair include the display, logic board, top case, the keyboard, trackpad, speakers, and battery. Participating repair shops must have an Apple certified tech, or must have Apple certified technicians, excuse me, to be able to perform the repairs. And participating shops are not permitted to offer whole unit replacements of Macs, and they cannot ship Macs to Apple repair centers on behalf of the customer. So if it needs to go into an Apple repair center, they have to give it back to the customer, and the customer will have to take it into an Apple store or send it in directly to Apple. The piece also noted that there is a new parts price list, and that while some of the components have gone down in cost, others have gone up, some up to hundreds of dollars, and they specifically cite the 13-inch MacBook Pro displays as an example. But regardless, Apple expanding out that program is going to give more repair choices to more consumers. So I think that's a good thing. I think there's many of us who would like to see Apple expand it even further and maybe allow it to go for devices that are not just out of warranty, but also Apple repairs as well. That gives consumers a lot more choice other than just having to go to Apple or the Apple Store. I have a feeling on Apple's side, though, they're trying to maintain their Apple Care relationships, and it's probably part of that. So it might be a little bit more complicated than it seems on the surface, but anytime they're allowing more aftermarket repairs, I think that's ultimately a good thing. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment, thank another show sponsor, and that is Linode. Hey, if you're looking to set up a server, if you maybe want to put together a website, or maybe you have a business application you need to deploy, the Linode Cloud is the perfect place to do that because they allow you to instantly deploy and manage an SSD server in their Linode Cloud. You can get a Linode Cloud server up and running literally in seconds with your choice of Linux distribution, resources, and choice of any of their 10 node locations. Best of all, they are giving all new MacCast customers a $20 credit so you can try out the service. They offer a lot more than just hosting. With Linode, you have all the options and choices to build a server with the services and features you need. Whatever your requirements, you can build it on Linode. Dedicated CPUs, distributed applications, hosted services, websites, and continuous integration and continuous delivery environments are all possible. All of their servers feature native SSD storage, a 40 gigabit network, and industry-leading processors, and you can pick from any of their 10 worldwide data centers. Best of all, their pricing is simple with no surprise fees. You pay for just what you use with hourly billing across all of their plans and add-on services. And their Cloud Manager control panel is amazing. It is super simple to use and makes managing your Linodes and upgrading your plans super easy. Visit linode.com/MacCast to set up your first Linode and get a $20 credit. That's linode.com/MacCast, linode.com/MacCast, and a huge thanks to Linode for their support of the show. So now we need to hop in the mystery van and grab our Apple snacks because we have a mystery to solve, kids, here in the next part of the show. I received this comment from Neil, and he ran into a little bit of a dilemma recently. So here's what he had to say.
Hi, this is Neil. I have been a longtime listener to your podcast and have learned a lot from it. I really appreciate what you do. Recently, I ran into a problem with a missing icon on the home screen of my iPhone 11 Pro Max running iOS 13.6. At the time this happened, I was using Google Maps for navigation in the car. Since I wasn't driving, I was also doing some other things on the phone. The app for Google Maps went totally missing from the home screen, and the other apps below it moved into position as if the app had been deleted, although the app continued to function fine. When I went to look for this using Siri, the Google Maps icon showed up in the search and launched Google Maps normally. Under the search, there was no indication that the Google Maps app was within a folder. I carefully looked through all the folders of apps on my phone and couldn't find it. I tried other ways to look for a missing app, but no luck. Checking on the App Store, all it would let me do was launch the app, not re-download it. Under the screen time limitations, I have set none, and there are no privacy or content restrictions that would interfere with the app showing up. All of my saved data within Google Maps seems to be okay. It is as if a flag had been set to hide the app, such as if there were content restrictions set, but there are none. I'm not sure how this could have happened or how to undo it. Any help that you or any of your listeners have would be much appreciated. My preference is to deal with this on the iPhone, if possible. I haven't yet tried synchronizing to my Mac to take care of it.
Hey, Neil, so that is an odd one to be sure, especially since you basically already mentioned a lot of the troubleshooting that I would have recommended that you go through, that you look for things like restrictions, that you go to the App Store. All of those things, I think, are really good. And I would say your best bet now would be to remove and reinstall the app. And I know you mentioned that you were not able to do this from the App Store, but luckily there is a feature in iOS, I think, that can help out here. And that is specifically offloading the app. And what offloading means is actually removing the application from your iOS device, because it's obviously still there. It looks like just the icon was missing. You already mentioned that the data is still there. So offloading removes the application from your iOS device, but retains your data. Because, you know, if you just delete the app, it's going to also delete the data with it. And I don't think you want to necessarily do that if you want to retain that data. Now, I'm not exactly sure what kinds of data Google Maps retains. I would imagine it would just be the mapping data, which could be re-downloaded. I don't know that it keeps any customized or personalized stuff, but just in case, you probably want to retain that data. Luckily, offloading your apps in iOS is pretty easy to do. You just go into the settings and you go under General, you tap on iPhone Storage, and then wait for the list of apps to load up. You'll scroll down that list, find Google Maps, and tap on it, and then tap the Offload App button rather than the delete button. And then you'll need to tap offload app again to confirm. And what that will do is it will remove the app from your device, but leave its documents and data alone. So then at that point, you should be able to reinstall or re-download and reinstall the app, and it should come back with your data. And hopefully the icon will come back. Now, typically it should come back in the same place as where it was deleted from. So if you have it, if you had it in a folder or something like that, it should come back into that location. And I would hope that that would get your icon back. Now, a little bit of a behind the scenes here. I actually emailed this solution to Neil before I recorded this podcast, and he responded to me to tell me that this solution wasn't the solution for him. It actually did not work for him, and that's because he actually discovered the real answer to this mystery, which was that apparently, and I didn't know this, and so this may be news to you as well, iOS has a limitation on the number of pages of applications that you can have, and that limit is 15. Now, I personally use folders, and I try to keep my apps down to a single page. I actually have two pages of apps on my iOS device, but a lot of people don't do that, or maybe just have a lot of apps. And so 15 pages is the limit. That is what iOS will display. And so somehow, in Neil's case, his Google Maps icon got moved from his first page and landed in the app purgatory pages, which exist outside somehow of the 15th page of apps. So apparently, once you have 15 pages of app icons, you can actually still have more apps installed on your device, but you can't get to them and you can't see them, which is what happened to Neil. And so what he noticed was that once he started moving apps into folders or deleting apps, the apps that were off in the 16th, 17th, 18th pages, I guess, that you can't really get to, would sort of start to slide into place on that 15th page. And apparently they come in, according to him, in alphabetical order, not in the order that they were installed. So you kind of have to get through all of them to kind of pull them back into place to be able to manage them. So what a pain in the neck, right? That's a little bit odd, and I don't know why Apple would have that limit if the apps kind of still exist on the phone. And this, I guess, is maybe why, or at least one of the reasons why, they are giving us the new app library in iOS 14 and just sort of managing our apps for us on that last page. Maybe that's making app purgatory now visible, I guess, or something like that. But very odd problem. Still the offloading app. I wanted to share the offloading apps thing with you because I think that's a very handy tip. It's a great way if you're out of storage space or running low on storage space on your device. You can actually use the storage management tools to automate this. You can tell iOS, yeah, go ahead, any apps that I haven't opened or used in a long time, go ahead and just automatically offload them. And that'll get you that app storage space back, but again, retain the data. So if that app has data with it and you ever need to open it again, you just simply tap on it on your device, it will re-download the app and you'll be good to go. But you don't have to leave the app stored on your device all of the time. So handy little feature. And Neil, I am glad that you were able to figure out what happened to this icon. I was really stumped by it, so I was happy to know the answer. And it's an odd one. I had no idea that there was this limit in iOS. I think back in the day I knew. I think at one point it actually was 9 pages or something like that. And I think they even increased it, if I'm remembering. But I had totally forgotten that there was actually a limit to the number of pages of apps that you could have on your device. Another little mystery that came up this week came from Fernando. He wrote in to describe something that was happening to him in Safari when specifically visiting Facebook. And I guess it's not really a mystery as it is a bewilderment, right? Something that was just bugging him. And what was happening was while using Facebook, he was continually getting a warning popping up at the top of his browser under the URL bar that said, quote, "This web page is using significant memory. Closing it may improve the responsiveness of your Mac." And he would dismiss the warning, and because mainly he wasn't noticing any performance issues or responsiveness issues with his Mac, but then that message would come back and it would pop back up. And what he was asking is there any way to just suppress that warning? Because again, he wasn't really having problems with it, it wasn't an issue. The only issue he was having was it kept popping up. It keeps popping, or that he is having, I guess rather, is that it keeps popping up this message. And he thought perhaps maybe a command line thing that he could run that would get that message to go away. And as far as I know, I don't think there is a way to suppress that warning or to get rid of it. So let's talk a little bit quickly, though, about why that warning exists. You may have seen this warning or a similar one. There is a actually sister kind of warning to this that will also pop up in Safari. And what's going on here is typically web pages, especially if they have a lot of scripts running, a lot of JavaScript running on their site, they can start to use up a lot of memory and a lot of resources. Also, sites that have a lot of auto-playing videos or ads, ad tracking. So you're seeing why Facebook might be one of these sites that comes up with these sorts of issues. Yeah, all of this stuff can eat up your system resources, which might eventually impact other apps. And so Apple decided in Safari to give you a little pop-up when you might be on a web page, because a lot of us, you know, browse to a web page and maybe you leave that web page open, sitting open in a tab. Just inside Safari, it could start eating up a lot of your system resources, including your memory. And so if you have Safari open, maybe you've navigated to a couple pages, you have a few tabs open, and then you navigate away, the operating system tries to manage all of that, but they want to let you know, hey, if you just close these tabs or get out of this website, we can give you some of your system resources back, and it maybe won't impact or affect your other apps and things like that. And so you can see this a lot with that. Another thing that can kind of eat up resources are extensions or plugins that you might have installed, because a lot of those use JavaScript that will load on the pages that you're visiting. So those can maybe pop things up. And like I said, sites that have videos or a lot of video content can maybe take those kinds of resources. And so that's what that warning is about. Now, the sister warning message that you might also see is one about energy usage. It will pop up and say, this web page is using significant energy. Closing it may improve the responsiveness of your Mac. And this is more likely to happen if you have a laptop. And basically, it's the same sort of thing, though. It's saying this page is using a lot of system resources, memory, CPU, and that will have a direct impact on your battery life, could reduce your battery life when you're using your Mac and surfing the web and stuff like that. So maybe you want to close out of those pages. So it's all there to kind of just help you. I know it can be a little bit annoying, especially if it keeps popping up and it doesn't seem like you're having an issue like was your case, Fernando. But as far as I know, like I said, there's nothing you can really do to prevent them. There is probably some things you can do that might help free up your resources if you're seeing them a lot and can maybe make them so they're not popping up so frequently. One tip that I have would be to maybe use an ad blocker to block some of those ads and tracking scripts that are running in the background on these websites. You can do that from inside Safari. You can go under the Safari menu and go to the settings for this website option and turn on ad blocking. You can also install an ad blocking extension if you want to use a third-party ad blocker. Another thing that you could do is, when you're in there, looking at those settings, is you can go under Safari Preferences and click on the Websites tab and then click on Content Blockers, and you can specifically turn content blockers on for specific websites. And so once you've enabled it through the Safari website settings or settings for the site, you can toggle them on or off. And you can also set a global setting when visiting any site from the Safari Preferences Websites tab. So you can go in there. Another thing, like I said, is auto-playing videos. If you want to be able to control those, again, go to the web page that has auto-playing videos, go under the Safari menu, choose settings for this website, and there is a option for controlling auto-play video. You can set that to never play or never auto-play video, and then for that site, it won't autoplay videos. And then if you want to be able to control the various websites that you have set up for that, again, that same websites tab in the Safari preferences will allow you to control that on a per site basis. And you can also, again, set a default option for all other websites. Either allow autoplaying of videos, you can stop autoplaying of media that has sound, or you can set it to never autoplay. So that's another thing you can do. And like I said, extensions, third-party extensions or plugins might have an impact on performance. So you can check if you have any of those and turn off any that you might not need. Again, go into Safari, go into Preferences, and just click on the Extensions tab, and you can see all of the extensions that you have loaded. And so if you do have any loaded that you're not using, just simply turn them off, and that will help free up some of your resources. You can also allow Safari to stop plugins to save power. So this would help out if you were seeing that, you know, hey, this website is using resources that might affect your battery life or might affect your energy settings. If you go into Safari Preferences and then click on the Advanced tab, there is a checkbox that you can check for stop plugins to save power. And if you check that on, then if plugins are using up a lot of resources and maybe affecting your battery life, Safari can go ahead and auto stop those plugins. And then finally, if you're seeing the pop-up a lot, you might want to try just clearing your browser cache. Go under the Safari menu and choose Clear History, or you can enable the Developer menu by going into Safari Preferences Advanced, turning on the Developer menu or selecting the Show Developer menu option, and then you'll have a new developer item in your menu bar, and under that you can go under that menu and choose Empty Caches, and that will clear your browser cache, and that might help out, again, sort of just freeing up maybe some cache resources and stuff like that. So those are all things that you can try to get rid of that message, but really just dismiss it. And if you're not experiencing a slowdown on your Mac, I wouldn't worry about it too much. Just keep, you know, using Facebook and enjoying the features of Facebook. Just know that, again, like I said, it does have kind of a lot of things running in the background. A lot of it specifically related to kind of their ad tracking that they have on their services. So, you know, just one of the dilemmas of maybe using a more resource-intensive website and Apple trying to be helpful. I guess it would be nice if they would add some sort of option that would let you toggle those messages on or off, whether you want to get them, because, you know, maybe you just don't care. And so it would be nice to not have to have that, because they can be a little bit annoying. But you shouldn't be seeing them popping up too much. If they're popping up a lot, try some of these other tips, and maybe some of these will help out. So thanks for your email, Fernando. Here's another little odd one that popped up and came in from a listener, Rick. This one having to do with setting reminders on iOS. And I think this one might be a bug in iOS 13.6. I'm running 13.6.1, so I don't know if it's just specific to that or if it goes back further. But what Rick noticed was that he could ask Siri to set a recurring reminder and ask it to be repeated on an hourly basis. So you could say something like, remind me to wash my hands every 4 hours. And then you would get a reminder, a recurring reminder in the Reminders app every 4 hours. But what he noticed was that you can't get that option manually in iOS. So if you open up the Reminders app and you add a new reminder and you go in and tap the little info icon and go to the remind me on a day option and then tap repeat to set the repeat option, there actually is no hourly option that you can set. It only does daily, weekly, monthly, and so on. And even under custom, the most frequent reminder level you can get is a repeat frequency, I guess would be the correct term, is day. And I tried this out on my iOS device, and sure enough, that was the case. Now, even more interestingly, is if you do set a recurring reminder to be hourly using Siri, and you go in to edit it in the Reminders app, you do have the hourly options, and you can change the frequency. Like, you can have it be every 4 hours or 6 hours or 8 hours, however you might want, but you can't set that up by manually adding a new reminder in iOS. Now, you can see the hourly option on the Mac, so I guess another workaround for this would be set your hourly reminders on the Mac and then just sync them through iCloud. This was at least in macOS Catalina 10.15.6 for me. So this is just an odd one, and Rick, I think really what you probably found is some sort of bug, because I would imagine you should be able to set it manually in iOS. I just don't know why those options don't appear. But if anybody else knows if there is a workaround for this, if there's some little trick to be able to manually set these up, obviously two workarounds are set them up on your Mac or just use Siri and that will work for you. But maybe there's a way to do it actually in the Reminders app. So maybe I'm just totally missing something, but Rick noticed this, I confirmed it. And so we'll throw it out to the community. Let us know what you have to say or if you've bumped into this little issue. And then finally for this week, I have a question from Andy who wrote in to ask about archiving or compressing files on the Mac and about the differences between the built-in compress option in macOS versus using third-party apps. And so I thought I'd try to kind of answer that question for you, Andy. I guess the first thing was you were asking about, you know, why the need, or is it a good idea basically to archive or compress files on your Mac, and why would you do it? And the main reason is to save space on your Mac. If you were running out of space, you could go in and compress that those files or folders. Another reason to use the compress option in macOS is it's a good way to send larger files or share larger files if you want to just get the file size down so whoever you're sending it to doesn't have to download such a large file. You could compress it first and then share it to them either, you know, through mail or through messages or through a sharing service like Dropbox or iCloud sharing, what have you. So that's kind of why it's there. For those who maybe don't know about this feature in macOS, it basically allows you to take a file or folder and compress it, make its file size smaller. It's built into your Mac. You can go into the Finder, select a file or folder, right-click or control-click on it, and then choose the compress option. And you'll see compress and then the name of the file. And what that will do is it will create a zip archive, a compressed archive of that file. So it'll create a copy of the file or folder and then compress everything in it. And if you compare the size of the original folder or file to the compressed file, you'll notice it'll be smaller. And how much it can be compressed really depends upon the file type and the files that are in there, because, you know, some files compress more easily than others. And also some files on your system are already in a compressed format. A great example of that is JPEG images. They use a lossy compression, so they're actually already partially compressed, so you can only compress them so much more. Whereas maybe a large text file or something like that, might compress a lot more or get a lot smaller in size when you run it through that compress feature. And as you noted, Andy, you don't have to just use Apple's built-in zip compression. There are a lot of different third-party apps that offer different kinds of compression, different compression algorithms. There's lots of different ways to compress files, and different software will use different algorithms or different options. I think even within Mac OS's built-in stuff, of course, Apple has what they've built into the operating system and you can access through the Finder. But if you're willing to go into the terminal and command line, you have a few different compression options and you can play around with the settings and maybe get a more compressed file or a less compressed file. So there are options. You know, third-party apps, those of us who've been around long enough probably remember StuffIt.sit files, StuffIt Expander. Yeah, that was the compression we used to use on the Mac back in the day. And then when Apple moved to their Linux-based operating system, they switched over to Zip, which is much more universal. And so it's kind of a great way to go because it's a long-standing compression format and it's supported on a lot of various platforms. So you can send it over to Windows, you can send it over to another Linux machine, and they should be able to handle Zip. Whereas some of the other third-party apps might use their own proprietary compression, and you may only be able to decompress a file that's compressed in that format with that third-party app. So that's something you have to watch out for when using third-party apps. So I just generally, if I want to compress something, I use the built-in stuff. I'll just zip it up in Mac OS and do it that way. But overall, I guess the other question Andy had was, you know, is it a good idea to compress your stuff? If you have a bunch of files and folders on your Mac and maybe you're not going to really access them, they're more just for archiving, should you go ahead and compress them? And I generally feel like no, I don't really do it. I guess if you're really, really tight on storage space on your drives, it might be an option. But with the prices of external drives and storage these days coming way, way down, I kind of feel like it's better to just archive your files on to other drives or media and just get them off of your Mac's main drive. And of course, when you do that, make sure that you have additional backups of those files, especially if they're critical files to use, really important stuff. Make sure you have an offline archive of that content, as well as, you know, just moving it to an external device or drive, whether that be a external hard drive or a USB stick or some sort of solid state drive, something like that. No matter what, make sure you have enough copies to keep it safe. You know, because drives fail and bits rot and not everything that's digital really lasts forever, you know, and a lot of times people find that out the hard way. So you have to kind of manage your data, and the more data you get, of course, the harder that is to do. But, you know, I guess if you really need to get storage space and all you have is your internal drive and you want to compress some things down, I've just generally found that you're not going to get that much savings. I think in some cases there are applications that will do it for you automatically, compress and decompress, but in general, I found it to just be kind of more hassle than it's really worth it. And again, you can just sort of put stuff onto external drives. You can really archive it in another way. But, you know, that's just my opinion. There might be other people out there that feel like compression is really a way to go. And maybe if you have a really great workflow that you use that includes compression, share that with us and let us know what you're doing. Shoot me an email or an audio comment if you're using compression in some creative way, or maybe you have a third-party app that you really like that helps do this stuff and manage this stuff for you. Let us know about it. Maccast@gmail.com. But with that, that is going to do it for the show for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a moment and thank my show sponsor, Smile, makers of Text Expander and PDF Pen. Also Text Expander for iPhone and iPad, and PDF Pen for iOS. You can get more information and details on all of their great applications by visiting smilesoftware.com/podcast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. You can find them at cachefly.com. And all advertising on the MacCast is handled by Backbeat Media. They are at backbeatmedia.com. As always, I love hearing from you. If you have a comment, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, you can send your emails and audio comments to maccast@gmail.com. You're also welcome to call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That phone number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And if you want to follow me on social media, you can find me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. You can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Or find me on Twitter, I am on Instagram. I am just MacCast on Instagram. But that is going to do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.